Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
That was the Sammy Kay Orchestra during World War II, and we're remembering Pearl Harbor today through the recollections of 10 different men who were there that day. Alabama native Russell Winsett was assigned to the battleship USS Pennsylvania, his duty station, a machine gun nest high up in the air.
Walking down the dock, I heard the siren to go off, battleship, man your station. Mm-hmm. And that's when I rushed aboard ship and went up to my machine gun nest. Lo and behold, ammunition boxes were locked. And I said, I'm not going to climb that ladder back down and back up to get the keys. So I took what they call a dog wrench. It was a pipe about this long and broke a lock. Lo and behold, some young ensign in the Navy, he wanted to put me on report for destroying government property.
He didn't think Japanese planes coming overhead and bombing you guys was a good enough excuse. Huh?
Right. So, anyway, the captain saw that what the report was, and he just shook his head, told it and some beat it.
So you heard the signal for general quarters. You get to your machine gun. Had you seen planes in the sky? Did you know what was happening, or was this just chaotic?
Well, all I could hear a lot, bombing and everything, guns shooting, but I had no idea what was going on. Where we sat in dry dock was up above most of them in the water, You could see a lot, but I knew it wasn't no drill. I knew it was for real.
So you man that 50 caliber machine gun, you bust open the ammunition box so you actually have something to shoot at them, and then what are you shooting at? What are you seeing as you look out on that scene?
Well, actually, I couldn't see too much because you had a band around you to hold you up to the gun, and I couldn't see much except when the plane would come in my scope there. I didn't know what was going on. I could hear a lot. It was pretty scary.
As far as what that looked like, the number of planes that were coming through, or how much time you had to react if you actually saw something, I imagine there's probably nothing that could prepare you for that.
Well, you figure you see two or three come over and are strafing. You knew there's going to be more, so you just sit and wait for them. That's all we can do.
How close did those planes come to where you were?
I'd say some of them 100 feet, come right over the bow of the ship.
You could see markings on those Japanese planes?
Oh, yeah. I could even see the pilot with a Japanese grin.
You could see the face of the pilot.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that was a long time ago. Long, long time ago. What did that feel like to be in that situation? Because now we look back and everybody knows, well, Pearl Harbor happened December 7th, 1941. But I can't imagine the feelings that must have been going through you because it was so unexpected for you.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Believe it or not, I never got scared until it was all over.
Hmm.
Because it really didn't have time to get scared.
How long do you think you were there in that position, continuing to man that machine gun?
Oh, probably a couple of hours.
Did it feel like longer?
Felt like all day.
Yeah, I bet.
A friend of mine, he was from Orlando or somewhere down here in Florida, and he was the ship's photographer. And he had climbed up a leg of the mast. It had ladders on it, and they climbed up there to get pictures. And they shot him right off, killed him. That hurt me bad.
When did you start to grasp the magnitude of what happened there that day? Not just with your ship, but the entirety of
Well, really, that happened about 8 o'clock in the morning. So after that, he had time to look around, and I'd say a couple of hours, you know, you could see the damage had been done, and you knew there was a lot of lives lost because those ships rolled over and were bombed and everything. A lot of people lost.
Can you paint a picture for us of what it looked like from your vantage point as you scanned the horizon, what you could see?
Well, it'd be kind of hard to describe, but out across the bay, or channel rather, we saw ships laying close to each other, some collapsed, some on fire. It was quite a deal there.
You could see smoke in the air?
Oh, yeah, smoke and flames, and you could smell bodies burning. That wasn't good.
No, and it was especially dire on the USS Oklahoma, as David Russ Russell knows all too well.
I was in the compartment just reading a book, and Lieutenant Rommel gets on the loudspeaker. He says, this is attack, fellas. And he didn't say this. He said that S word. And boy, that woke us up. About that time, those torpedoes start hitting us. And pow, 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 pow. The 9 of them hit us.
And where were you?
I was in the compartment. And those torpedoes just hit me, well, probably 80 feet from me and just across from me there.
So what did that feel like?
Oh, my goodness. You know, as clean as those ships were, dust. I don't know where the dust came from, but it probably come from the blowers, the air blowers.
Mm-hmm.
You started coughing, so much dust. It's unbelievable.
Well, it sure seems like there's nothing that could prepare you for this. And you're trying to figure out what in the world's going on, probably, right?
Yeah, what do I do next? When he said air attack, I had two battle stations. If we came under air attack, I was to sink cover. I had to go down below decks, below the armor decks. And if we go to surface action, my battle station was the 5-inch 51s. They were in casemates alongside the ship.
Uh-huh. So where'd you go?
So air attack, I went down below decks. And I went down. That hatch I went through is 13 and a half inches thick armor plate. From 13 and a half inches down to 8 inches, 3/4 inch length of the ship. And they started to close the hatch, and I said, well, you know, my mind started operating, and I said, I've been trained to be a first loader on an anti-aircraft gun. In case somebody gets hurt, I can replace them. And by the time I got out of that ship, it was halfway over. Yeah, it began to capsize, you know, right away.
Yeah. You said the number, 9 torpedoes, and that ship
several bombs, yeah.
And it's starting to turn over, ends up tipping over something like 150 degrees, right? I mean, almost completely upside down.
And trying to get out of those compartments, you know, people were dogging, you know, they dog everything down, those hatches. There's 8 dogs on every hatch. It's not like these quick disconnect hatches that we have today. But I would try to undog them. Somebody else on the other side would dog them down. And then I had to climb over lockers. The concussion or the explosions caused those lockers to break loose. So I had to divert myself around to get out or climb over the lockers.
Have you ever stopped to think about what if I hadn't made that decision to go topside when I did?
Those men are still down there. Yeah, they got trapped, yeah.
And of all the ships at Pearl Harbor, only the Arizona lost more men than the Oklahoma.
429 we lost, mm-hmm. A lot of my friends. Uh-huh.
So when you did get to the surface or to the top of the ship, it's already starting to roll over?
The water just began to come over the main deck there. And the ship was, about 80 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
About ready to capsize there.
So if you're on the top, you're really on the side with the way the thing is turning.
Yeah, the deck is facing you, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The water hose coming across, I grabbed a water hose and just hand over hand myself up. Oh, then I went down over the side.
Because the ship's turning, you're basically climbing to get to what was the side, which is now the top, and then you slid off into the water?
No, the half-inch thick steel plates, they were riveted together, so I just went down and I got a hold of the edge of that, and I just gave one big leap, and I caught a line from the Maryland. We were tied alongside.
Uh-huh.
And I got a whole, see, there was fire coming down between the two ships.
Right.
From the Arizona. And I didn't want to get that water because I'm afraid that, you know, the way the wind was blowing that fire down. And I thought, oh my, you know, I could see those guys walking in that fire and swimming in it, trying to push that oil away from them, but they just couldn't do it. But anyway, I called up on the to Maryland, and they were at general quarters. They're firing their 1.1 guns, anti-aircraft guns. So I just over there, and I wanted a few instructions on how to handle that ammunition. And I got it, and so I helped them pass ammunition.
Russ would have to wait another day to find out that his uncle had been rescued from the capsized hull of the Oklahoma, something the late Richard Swede Artley told us about on this program from his firsthand experience. A story in which the relief of survival is tempered by the sobering reality that Artley's older brother, Darryl, was killed on the Oklahoma that day.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma, and very likely 10. I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees, just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water. I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, was a heavyweight wrestler. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose.
When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, hell, I slept some of the time down there. And the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him just a short time before he died. I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment went completely full of water? And he said, oh, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there's a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done. Oh, I was scared.
When did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Darryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Darryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Darryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later. I used to think about him all the time.
Those words from Mr. Artley, recorded just 3 weeks before his passing, were the last ones I included in a presentation this week at Hillsdale College in Michigan, where Hometown Heroes airs on affiliate WRFH. As I looked around that room and a crowd ranging in age from preteen to nonagenarian, I spotted many wiping the tears away from their eyes, and I was reminded again of how powerful these stories can be when we just take the time to let them sink in. How grateful we should be for those who have paid the price for our freedom, and how motivated we should be to make sure that our lives assign a value to that freedom that is worthy of the price. As I remind you that the original interviews with each of the 10 Pearl Harbor survivors you heard from today are linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, I'm hoping that this hour has helped you understand even more deeply what I mean when I conclude each installment of this program with those same four words. Freedom is not free.